State Representative Tacky Chanda Quincy is joining us once again for another Tacky Talk on a Thursday today, Tacky.
Good morning. It's Thursdays with Tacky, and great to see you, Joe. It's a cloudy day. We're waiting for rain.
Yes, indeed. Things have changed for sure, unfortunately. But I think, most notably, we should mention today we're recording this on the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of Normandy, France.
Yeah, I watched the news this morning regarding, I believe, the First Lady in France going through the memorial ceremonies and just a raw number of lives that many young men gave to basically start the end of World War II, to be honest, and the largest amphibious campaign ever mounted in the history of man. And this includes like ancient era naval excursions where, they're trying to move tens of thousands of folks. It doesn't matter what decade you're in, the daunting task of moving large number of men and equipment, whether it be, tanks or horses, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the logistics are insane. And, and even just keeping that under wraps is incredible. One of the things that's kind of remarkable about D-Day is the fact they kept it in secret so long, despite the fact that Germans kind of can guesstimate where to land, because it's not like the whole Normandy or France at all is can be drop a lot of folks off, and it's a killing field once you get off, right? So, German defenses obviously was mounted everywhere, but obviously don't want to have the highest concentration of defenses where they believe troops would land. And I mean, I always thought one of the remarkable things was just the sheer amount of disinformation that Allied forces were able to put out to really have German defenses guessing where they were and whether or not to deploy resources in the right areas. And it was kind of a bit chaotic, as you can tell. Everyone's seen Private Ryan in other similar movies and documentaries. You realize once the battle starts, it isn't like there's instant communication. It's just get there. And it's a lot of sacrifice by heroes to bring into a terrible war, start the end of a terrible war, and obviously keep our freedoms that we enjoy today, but not just here, but all over the world.
Yeah, it's just the importance of it cannot be overstated, certainly. And of course, many of the survivors are, now centenarians. They were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old then. So they're in their late 90s or 100 or better.
Yeah, no longer with us is Bob Noble, right? A guy who's very humble, was a POW, was a parachuter during Normandy. I won't forget the part where he dropped a lot of young boys and men out of airplanes with not a whole ton of training. If anyone has a chance, I wonder if Bob Bosworth has the Bob Noble interview somewhere again to put back up. I haven't read it in a long time, but I mean, I remember Bob telling me that they exactly have a lot of parachute training.
Right.
Here's a parachute. Here's how it does it. There was no like test run, and you hope the thing opened.
And then, what do you do once you get there? Just astounding what these young men did, and to this day, it deserves to be remembered for certain.
Yeah, and also support staff, which also composed of a lot of women, behind all this, doing everything from communication to logistics and intelligence, as well as, monitoring the situation the best they can. And sadly, of course, a lot of administrators that weren't on the battlefield had to do the help do identification and notification. There's heroes all around. The greatest sacrifice of those who laid their lives, but there's a lot of support staff that made it happen, whether you're a welder or a medical person or administration, or perhaps that sad job of the identifying and notifying family of the passing of your family member.
Right. Yeah.
People kind of can forget it's a real team effort that we to do things in America. And it can't be easy if you're doing logistics from the back, because what's happening.
Exactly. Yeah. So, certainly here in Quincy, I don't know of any other community really that does so much for its veterans in terms of recognizing, honoring, and assisting them.
Yeah, if I have a chance, definitely drive by Four Point Square. You see the island of flags. It's beautifully done. And then you have obviously a new setup in walls and cemetery, which we were there Memorial Day parade at the end, and it's lovely. And then you see a lot of these markers on street corners with names and small flags right now, and those markers represent people that lived in your neighborhood. In some cases, well before your time of moving here, made the ultimate sacrifice. And of course, we have Caddy Park, which is one of the youngest. What is it? I can't remember. No, I can't remember things. Congressional Medal awardees after death, and then you have at the various schools different memorials, and we still have sailor cemeteries, which I have to say is quite remarkable. One's near my house off Fennel Street, and then of course you have the one behind Snug Harbor School that I know of. And you look at the gravestones and the dates, some of them are not that far off after the Civil War. And of course you have the obviously Walsall Cemetery has a lot of very old gravestone military families, and you also have like Pine Hill Cemetery. And where you want to go back in time, have the very old cemetery across from the Church of Presidents next to City Hall. And you can see some very old gravestones, and unfortunately the markings aren't exactly as detailed as the ones we have in the modern day. So I mean it's a bit of American history that's in Quincy, and Quincy has a disproportionate number of folks that went into the military, and compared to the rest of the state in percentage of population. And we also have a lot of casualties, over well past 100 years of men and now women who laid their lives on the line every day and be able to come home, and unfortunately some make the ultimate sacrifice or are unable to.
Right.
So, but they all equally ensure that we are able to enjoy the life we have today. And people hate the word global police officer, but the United States is a stabilizing force, throughout the world as much as possible. As they talk about, like, just trade is a big part of it, but also just the presence of which creates some stability in the area. Sometimes just being there is enough to deter stupidity, so to speak. Hence, we have NATO, right? And creating new Asia Pacific bloc agreements. I wouldn't call it quite alliances, but some are alliances, but some are agreements. And even NATO's, considering whether or not they should have a Pacific component, given the fact that we live in a global world. As I like to tell folks, I mean, two of the worst wars on a global level came, actually, two of the worst come out of Europe, but every time there's a European war, everybody else pays the price. Even the Napoleonic War was kind of a global war, right? I mean, it did bleed into the Americas, as well as all the other colonies that are held by the French and the English around the world. And even World War II, what is untold is that they brought a lot of Indian labor. Not entirely sure that was voluntary, but I'm fairly confident probably wasn't. And Indian labor was brought in specifically, to be support and on the front lines of World War One. The British just dragged a bunch of folks out and said, "You're going to fight here, thousands of miles from home," not knowing where they were. So, the British did some not nice things to people, I think, putting it mildly in world history. But it's global warfare, which is why everyone's like, "Well, why do we care about Ukraine?" I mean, have we not seen the history of Europe? Every time they do something, everyone pays the price. It's not just World War I, World War II. I mean, you look at anywhere when they started imperialism and colonization, everyone paid the price.
So, well, interestingly, the current president of Ukraine is in Normandy to mark D-Day, so he recognizes the importance, certainly.
Yeah, Zelensky, is in a horrible position, right? I mean, he's, trying to stay in the front of people's limelight, keep in front of mind, as you guys all know, watching news cycles in the world do cycle, not more so than America. The United States has a huge, like, fast cycle movement on news, and While there is some news to Ukraine, it's really kind of moved on to other news stories, whether domestic or international. Other parts of the world actually pays attention to international. It's actually part of the regular news cycle. It's very different from here. We really do not pay attention about the rest of the world, unlike other countries. And Zelensky obviously is running a country with no revenue generation because they can't tax anyone when everything's getting blown up. So they're living a government on basically EU and US assistance to pay for the government, just to keep the infrastructure going. Plus, you need weapons and, keeping the military. And I think anybody's been observing this has become a war of attrition. Who can outlast who in the death count? And who's going to be most exhausted? And Putin's war on terror is designed to turn the civilian population against the government, which has not worked so far. The just the person in the street, Ukraine, is in some of the most war-torn areas, is still living there, and they're just holding on in defiance. And there is no like civilian rebellion against the president and the government. And 10 million out of 40 million Ukrainians are still not inside of Ukraine. It's one of the biggest exoduses of a country. And Putin's obviously been very strategic. He's changed his defense minister already some months back. And Ukraine's issue is he's very aware that it's a public relations campaign. People like winners. We all like winners. So as a result, he knows that if he can't demonstrate some advancement, global public opinion is going to label him a loser, and being a loser equals genocide in their case, because the Russians aren't going to sit around and just decide they're going to keep a portion of that population alive anymore. And
Right.
I think initially they were going to do assimilation. They're going to bring him into the Russian fold and just basically force him to destroy Ukrainian culture and then assimilate him into the Russian public over time. But I'm getting this distinct feeling now that Putin's decided that he's just going to, if they take the country, they're going to do just straight up genocide of a portion of the country to lay down the law that they're in charge. That's the feeling I'm getting. Because initially, you want to maintain infrastructure. You want to hold the infrastructure together. You're going to invade and hold land because you're not just there to destroy. You want to hold on to the property because you're trying to assimilate them, destroy Ukrainian culture and assimilate into Russian culture. And given the last year and a half, plan seems to have gone away in favor of terror. And I really believe at some point that Russia's going to adopt a position of we just got to reduce the size of this population to make it manageable. This is not a new concept, by the way. When you're invading an area, generally a military power will make a decision that the most what best way to manage a conquered country is to basically just reduce the size of the people.
Scary thought for sure.
Yeah, Zelensky's in a tough position. I mean, I don't know who in listening here, thinks it's important to them. But again, I mean, the Europeans obviously know that, you're not just necessarily having a buffer, so to speak, land buffer, but it's a prelude for other things that could come. And there's always this complexity with natural oil and gas and this, trade. I mean,
Right.
and those of us who do air travel, I haven't traveled over the Pacific in a long time, but I mean, or to Europe, but if you're traveling, you can't go over Russian airspace, which actually reroutes the entire global airline industry and actually increases fuel consumption because of the Russian airspace being closed. Same thing of the Russian economy too. I mean, they're having issues moving people around and goods too by air. So there's a lot of things happening here still, and we're kind of getting used to it. And some of it doesn't affect us in the same way because it's not like a lot of people listening regularly travels, to the Pacific.
Right.
Not everybody here travels through Europe to try to get over Russia, to try to get somewhere else, in the borders of India and China, because you generally will go over Russian airspace to do that. So, I mean, probably doesn't affect you, but it does affect a lot of people. And, Zelensky's in France because he needs to keep in front of people to remind people that we're still here. They're not dead. We're still fighting. And we still need help because I think people forget that. I mean, how do you run a government when your country's pretty much 25 to 30% wrecked, right? How do you collect taxes when there's no business? You need foreign assistance just to do the basics, not necessarily just run the military. I was talking to one of my colleagues about this, and they're like, you do realize you can't collect taxes when your country's been destroyed. I mean, but
Yeah.
schools are open, right? They're open to have schools and bomb shelters. I mean, they still have grocery stores. They're trying to, they keep losing power, and they're those civil service workers and engineers and firefighters and policemen and ambulance and doctors are fighting, in places where shelling is indiscriminate. The bomb schools, the bomb hospitals, the bomb everything intentionally, not looking for a military target, not looking for a military component. They're just doing it.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about what's going on in Gaza right now either with Israel and Hamas. That's also a world concern.
It is. It's another very much a human tragedy, but I also like to keep reminding folks. I mean, you have 1,200 people that were murdered and countless others they still can't figure out fully anymore, is what I'm hearing. They were raped and kidnapped and tortured. And they're going to be collecting, sadly, a lot of not just Israeli citizens, but also expatriates such as Americans, Thai, and other countries where Hamas terrorists are just going to mutilate bodies. I mean, come on, folks. I mean, people don't think that's real. It is real. And the problem is, again, it's a tiny space of land. Israelis can give a lot of warnings, but there's a lot, not a lot of place to run. So Israelis do actually attempt to give, notice for folks to get out of the way. The problem is that where do you get out of the way too, right? And even the U.S. and other news outlets have visualizations of these, tunnels underneath hospitals. Like, the human shield thing is kind of the big difference here. And Hamas is a government. I keep reminding people, Hamas is the government of Gaza. The old PLO is the government of the West Bank. And the Gazans are not part of the Palestinian PLO parliament. They're its own entity. It is a government. That's why it's kind of called a war, because it's one government versus another government. The Gazan government, as you already, we also all discovered is, I knew nothing but about the economy of Gaza, but they have no economy.
Right. No, it's terrorist government is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, 100% foreign aid.
Right.
And what do you think the Gazan terrorists were using with that foreign aid, right? And there's this accountability that's really hard to figure out is, well, that foreign aid never made it to the population in a substantive form. The Gazan government terrorists kept it for themselves. And there's no elections. They do horrible things to their own people. But those people have nowhere to go because no one will take them. And this is kind of a part of the conversation, like they keep saying, is that, the Egyptians are holding at the line against, refugees trying to get over. You should try a large strip of Israeli land to try to get the Hezbollah, which is still shooting missiles all over Israel to Lebanon. But the Lebanese don't want them. Well, actually, the Hezbollah doesn't want them. I don't see Jordan or Saudi Arabia jumping up and down saying, hey, we'll take the civilians to get my harm's way if you want to clear out the terrorists. You're able to move 40 million people out of Ukraine. Good luck moving one out of Gaza.
Right.
And the U.S. Obviously took refugees from Ukraine, but that's after the bordering countries accept and confirmed. And not all Ukrainians were able to get out. If you didn't have confirmation documents like a passport and other similar documents, you're still trapped at the Polish border. So it's not like every Ukrainian got out. So you got these refugee camps on the edge of the Polish border because they're having identification problems to confirm who they are in a way into Poland.
Right.
You have this, human tragedy on both sides. A lot of Israelis killed, and unfortunately, 5 to 10 times as many Gazans is the way it's looking like, unfortunately. But I mean, the Gazan government has a responsibility for its people, and people kept saying, oh, it's Israel. I'm like, yeah, but it takes two sides. And clearly, the terrorists in Gaza do not care about their population.
Yeah, they've been offered a ceasefire agreement, and it just sits unfulfilled.
Well, I mean, they're not going to turn over their killers. I mean, this is not going to happen. I mean, they're not going to say, okay, we apprehended. I mean, this was any other reasonable government of country in the world. Okay, we're going after these criminals. We're going to work together. We'll catch these criminals. We're going to hand them over, or we're going to bring justice at home on them, or something. No, that's not happening. This is not a civilized government in the sense that, they know who did it. They're the ones that did it, right? So, anywhere in the world, no one wants to talk about that either. I mean, they know who did it. I mean, justice should be brought to those folks, but they were never going to do it. We all know they were never going to do it. If somebody was in under some pretense that, Hamas was like, okay, we're going to round up these guys that, rape, murder, killed, all these Israelis and hand them over. It is not going to happen.
Right.
And, that's kind of part of it as well. But I mean, you can see the stark difference on the civilian impact in both. But it's very, very different. Very, very different circumstances. It's not a fair comparison. And one of the biggest reasons is the neighboring states around Israel obviously hate Israel. People forget that. The neighboring states around Ukraine, most are okay with them, except Russia. And then you have again a civilian population that nobody wants. Well, in Ukraine, the neighbors were taking them in the best they could. And then from there were relocated globally, for lack of PTSD and adjustments to someplace to live, not knowing if they can ever go home.
Right.
Because its home's also not there, perhaps. But yeah, I mean it's not a fair comparison, not just because of the circumstances, but also how their neighbors behave. And I think this is lost on folks. They're oversimplifying a very complicated situation.
Yeah, it's I just think it's important to talk about on this anniversary of D-Day, how important still the US military is around the world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the presence in Korea keeps the North Koreans at bay. Presence in Okinawa. I know there's a lot of controversy with the Okinawans and in Japan and the U.S. presence there. But I mean, they also patrol and protect that part of the sea. It's close enough to Taiwan that if it gets strange, they can move in. There's a U.S. military base in Singapore. When the Philippines gave up their lease to the U.S., they Singaporeans accepted. U.S. military presence, and but now the President Marcos of Philippines, they're allowing U.S. presence on, I think, up to eight and probably more coming military bases for joint operations and staging areas for U.S. military. And of course, everyone forgets the Australians. The Australians are, a key military, air, naval, and land based forces which provide security for the surrounding areas such as New Zealand. So, Australians is there. Key security, military security region. People in America kind of forget that is that we're not just there alone. You have other long time partners from World War I and World War II in their zone. And you got the big,
Yeah.
big scary army in India, which is among the biggest standing armies on the planet. Now we can debate the efficiency of that army, but there's a lot of people, and they're the biggest border threat to China.
Yep. So a lot going on for sure.
Yeah, and the U.S. military presence Middle East, military presence in Africa, obviously in Europe,
Germany, of course, has been there since World War II, yeah.
yeah. So I mean, it's kind of like you shoot at U.S. troops, there will be a consequence. And again, U.S. has a policy, to bring back U.S. citizens from dangerous situations. I mean, it's a U.S. policy. That's actually part of the U.S. military presence. If we need to get people out of an embassy or get civilians out, via embassy or other places that I won't say safe, but someplace, U.S. military can get there quickly and do that. And we all know that basically aircraft carriers are flying cities. I mean, floating cities. I mean, aircraft carriers just is a floating city. It has like literally everything on it. And it has, oddly enough, space for massive evac situations. They can reconfigure these monster ships to any kind of situation you need, whether it be military or civilian rescue or humanitarian aid. It's I think people don't realize that the modular nature of these floating cities do so much. And I didn't realize, but when I was in San Diego, I mean, I was on the Midway aircraft carrier. And that, even back then, the ship 40, 50 years ago was also basically a convertible aircraft carrier. It could do anything. It's like a third, it's like two-thirds of the size of a modern aircraft carrier now, but it's monstrous. But, when you go through the tour and you look at the way the space is configured, yeah, it's cramped. I mean, it's a ship. But yeah, it really is designed that if we're going to do rescue operations, they can just reconfigure like large chunks of it to do something else. People perceive this as just strictly like a military thing. It's not. It's It's like a multi-use, not just military, but also emergency rescue, evac, moving goods around. I mean, it's quite remarkable.
Let's bring it back home for a little bit, Tacky, and talk about some statehouse news.
Yeah, we were at the State House last night, about 9:30 or so, doing a housing bond bill, about $6.2 billion, a substantial larger from the last one we did some years back at one point. I think it's 1.2 billion. We're making a very substantial investment on a wide range of areas, ranging from creating more veterans housing, doing some decarbonization of I mean, look here. Heat pumps in public housing. Excuse me. Doing some stuff, local housing partners, about $200 million investment, $1 billion investment in maintenance resilience with existing public housing, which is much needed on a statewide level. We did something for the South Shore, $1 billion to look at expanding MWRRA. Water basin expansion in the South Shore areas, whether or not we can help other communities south of us to be a member of that. 275 million for accelerating greenhouse modular homes. We do a capital authorization for Momentum Fund, which is to leverage resources for multifamily development. And then we put $150 million to help conversion of commercial property to residential property. We've talked about this before. Just because you're commercial space doesn't necessarily mean that you can convert to residential. You have that one bathroom or three bathrooms on one floor, and you're going to put in maybe like 25, 30 units. Every unit has its own bathroom. You can't do dorm style. I
Right,
think
and kitchens, obviously, and yeah.
it's a lot of like real, like you just can't just decide to make commercial space, residential overnight. Some stuff, we do some. Let's just skip over some of these things here on this long list of a fact sheet. We do the community investment tax credit, going to 15 million from 12 million. Groups like Neighborhood Works uses investment tax credit to create veterans, disability, and affordable housing. A lot of rehab. Every region has some kind of a community development corporation, CDC. Obviously, they're tailored towards each region. Every part of the state's very different. We do a home ownership tax credit for affordable homes, first-time home buyers who are not above 120% of area median income. We do some more stuff on housing choice initiatives, about $50 million for that. We do some $25 million to grants to help cities and towns do planning and zoning, so we do some grants there. We do housing stabilization investment fund, $425 million, to help preserve and construct and rehab existing home projects. And then we do some stuff regarding $200 million for rental housing assistance programs for single occupancy and transition, which includes veterans and seniors and persons with disability. Some other interesting stuff on the policy level. I mean, one of the ones that I think is great is the alternative housing voucher. To expand that, not just from senior citizens who are with disabilities, but expand it to the rest of the adult population. This is the alternative to what we call the MSRVP, which is the program similar to Section 8, which is what everyone talks about, which is really a federal program. So no one really hears about this, but it's the Alternative Voucher Housing Program, HVRP, which is really targeted at persons with disabilities.
Oh, okay.
And that program has been very successful creating independent living for people who have disabilities, who are senior citizens. I think expanding it is great because it's to other adults, because it encourages independence. What else is in here? We do some stuff with the architectural board. We do some simple reforming the board a bit regarding its membership. We do some vacant land studies. The state obviously has some vacant land. It's a good idea to kind of take a look at that. One of the more controversial things that we're talking about in caucus, a number of members, is the accessory dwelling units, or what they refer to as in-law apartments.
Yeah.
I did a year on the zoning board here before I got elected. Those issues, they come up, and I'm going to tell you right now, they're not easy to build. An in-law apartment is not easy to put in your home. There's a lot, you just have to comply with setbacks, you have conservation commission issues. You know, it can be very expensive because it has to be in law. So we actually allow, we're going to allow it by right on a permit for anything less than 900 square feet. But by right only crosses the first barrier about a zoning issue, whether or not you're allowed to do so. But it doesn't take away all the other requirements. For example, you have by right to build a deck, but you still need a building permit. You still have environmental issues depending where you're located. You still have construction requirements. You still need meet. Well, a deck doesn't have fire code, but you know, if you're doing a house renovation or addition for in-law apartment, internal dwelling unit, you know, you still have to do things like fire code requirements and emergency access and safety and you know all that stuff. So it is a very costly endeavor. The chair of housing, actually, my friend Jim Rosero, he actually came out of the Senate. He was a Senate Ways and Means guy as well. So we actually had crossed paths in our younger days. When I worked for Mike Morrissey, and this is his first big debate. You know, congratulations to Jim. I probably can't hear this because he's not on the South Shore. He's Westford, which is near Chelmsford Low area.
Well, we're online too, so he can hear it.
Yeah, so I'm not sure Jim's going to hear this, but congratulations, Jim, on your first big debate. You got to manage 373 amendments over the course of 24 hours, and had to manage 159 eight members, you know, asking for stuff out of you. So he did a great job trying to narrow the outside sections of policy issues strictly to housing related issues. I
Right.
did make note of that. I did notice the policy stuff was really narrowly tailored. Anything outside of that zone was not accepted. And you know, they, you know, did some stuff on earmarks with some colleagues. But I mean, in Quincy, a lot of the stuff in housing falls around our neighborhood works and the public housing, and the current bonding already includes a lot of it to help those existing agencies. So, you know, but good job, Jim. I mean, you know, you managed a very difficult situation. You know, your first big debate isn't easy in the State House. It's your first.
So, does the Senate have a version too, or how does it, what does it go from here?
It's going to the Senate. You know, it's going to be reviewed by their bonding committee and their ways committee, ways and means committee. And I'm not sure what's going to happen next. I mean, as I like to say, July 31st is coming up, and today is June 6th, as we mentioned at the top of the hour. So time is ticking, and I don't know what their plan is on the other side.
Okay, I know it's significantly more than the governor's recommendation, actually.
Yeah, we felt that, you know, given the fact these bond authorizations range between 10 and 30 years, depending on which part of the bond bill, you know, it gives a lot more flexibility for this governor and future governors to access funds and be able to authorize, well, we authorize, but to appropriate bond monies as needed as we have the changing times. So, you know, these authorizations for multi-year, you know, as the housing plan or housing development moves forward. On, you know, not just this governor and perhaps some future governors. I can't predict what's going to happen if Governor Healey's staying, Governor Healey's going. I have no clue, right?
Right.
So, you know, it gives some ability to continue the work, whether it be starting today or maybe they'll start it 2 years from now, but they know they have some bonding ability available. However, you know, I always remind folks we have a self-imposed bond cap that has been going on since Bill Weld won his first term. Where you know we bond based on CPI every year regarding expansion. So, you know, we're looking at somewhere maybe $2.3 billion annually we can bond statewide. We do have a kind of a debt cap, which is about I think $22 billion. Maybe I haven't looked. I keep forgetting to look because the number moves based on CPI. And then, you know, we also have you know, a lot of leveraging. So, you know, whether or not we can do matches against the federal government, which can be bond or cash, which again, you know, we did that early this year regarding using the interest from the rainy day fund to leverage federal grants because we want to be first in line. If you got dough, we get money, you can get between 80 and 90% covered by the federal government. So it is in our best interest, but maintaining our debt payments and the total budget of below 5%. I think it's closer to under four, actually, where our budget is very modest regarding debt payments. Those of you who have a business, those who have a mortgage at home, know how debt, eats into your budgets. And it's very important for the state to maintain a low debt load on its budget. And, remember fixed costs. I mean, our fixed cost is 50%. Medicare, Medicaid, MassHealth, it's all one thing, folks, in terms of our budget. And, obviously local aid in Chapter 70. So, your assistance to city and towns, which, Quincy amounts well past $60 million, or it's $420 million budget, is a fixed cost. So it's imperative the state's able to continue to bond to help our infrastructure out, but we also got to keep our debt payments, very reasonable.
Right. Yeah. It's a balancing act, right? Make sure that checkbook balances all the time.
It is the job of the Secretary of Ministry of Finance, the job of House and Senate Ways and Means, and the membership, getting updates from those bodies. But it's also the job of the governor and the state treasurer. The governor has to decide when to try to fit these things under the cap. And the treasurer's job, of course, is to start releasing bonds at the best value possible. And of course, we're in rising interest rates, and it's very competitive for not just Wall Street, but normal citizens. Who can access brokerage accounts or other things, your financial investor. Talk to your financial investor, folks, before you make investments. Strongly advise, go talk to your financial advisor to basically, like you say, be part of the solution, or perhaps own a piece of the rock. You can call it whatever you want. Talk to a financial advisor, whether it makes sense to be, a participant in a high interest rate environment of the treasurer trying to get the lowest interest rate possible, when we issue state bonds.
Right. Yeah. Interestingly, I think I read earlier this morning they're starting to cut rates in Europe. The Eurozone is starting to lower borrowing rates.
Yeah, they were at 4%. It's
Yeah.
down to 3.75, if I remember correctly. I think the president of the board actually dissented
That
on
sounds right. Yeah.
it was it's very unusual to have the board president dissent on this. She didn't have a lot of commentary, but it looks like Europe's inflation is starting to come under some level of control. It appears that way. They've avoided a true recession. They've had a technical recession like we did. It's technically a recession, but nothing super bad happened. But I want to make this note too that I've been listening to some news regarding surveying, and I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but I was talking to some friends this weekend, and we're talking about the lack of critical thinking that's really taught in colleges. She's the one I was talking to was much younger than me. She just got out of college, okay? So this is coming from a horse's mouth situation. She's like, there's more critical thinking for her in high school, she thinks, than it was in college level. And she's also from overseas, so she has like a couple of different comparisons, even though she spent the majority of time schooling here through high school and college. So it's kind of like inside out looking opinion. But I mean, the challenge critical thing, but also like the lack of proper information. So we're discussing, a lot of different topics, but people were surveyed about whether or not we were in a recession, and 59% said yes. But
Just
unemployment,
not true, yeah.
it's not true. We're not in a recession. Inflation's not a recession. It's the total
Right,
opposite. And
right.
people thought that the jobless rate was high. They think the entire economy is spiraling. People don't have jobs. But vacancies, as you all know, you can't find me anybody that's listening to not have a problem regarding customer service somewhere or your business trying to hire people. You have vacancies. So that's clearly wrong. Unemployment numbers are coming tomorrow in the feds. I expect to be still under 4%. The state government is 2.9%. We're 1% point lower than the federal government. So we are not having unemployment, but over 50% believe we did. And then 49% of the public believe that the stock market is in a free fall. The market is crashing horribly. We are on a record Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ right now. And the NASDAQ's been the weakest one of all of them. It's been struggling to grow as fast as S&P, and particularly S&P's out of control in growth. So it's been the strongest market in history so far, after having a pretty horrific fall of 2022, which is a natural kind of correction in some ways after interest rates went up. So there's a degree of like just media literacy or paying some attention that, when you have that size of population, with 100% fiction, basing their information on God knows where,
Right.
is pretty frightening. example, something that, this ain't international stories. This ain't, stories of DC. This is something that's right in front of your face.
It's very easy to access this information from multiple sources, legitimate sources, folks. I think that's what I think is being fueled by is a lot of social media chatter.
Yeah, and but you can see it in front of you. I mean, we talk about more than one time our experience in supermarkets, right? You're in a long line. There's no workers, right? I mean, you have friends retiring younger, changes the workforce, right? Wages have gone up, but prices have gone up. So everyone's feeling an awful pinch, right? There are people taking vacations. The economy is awful. Nobody's going anywhere. You are not flying. You are not using hotels. You are not planning a trip. You're not going to your friend's wedding because you have no money, right?
All untrue, yeah.
Yeah, it's all untrue. I mean, I know that people are very challenged. I know that housing continues to be a big challenge. I think it's like
Sure.
1.6% of the state's housing is available, barely 1.6%. I mean, I get all that, and but it's very scary to me when I hear that kind of data sets because it's not like we're talking about overseas and we're not talking about things that are really far away. We're talking about stuff that's on as a main street issue. This is stuff you feel and see when you go out your door, or even at home. I mean, everyone loves Amazon, right? So, it's very peculiar. It's very concerning. It's very concerning. I mean, the lack of the right proper media, but also just critical thinking. I mean, and this student said that, well, she's a graduating student, she's going to master's in California, but she's kind of like, hey, it's kind of concerning. Because she talks to her, people in undergrad and master's program, and it's just, she's like, this is, kind of curious. So then it bled into this whole conversation about stuff I'm hearing in the economy, and the surveying is it's very, very, very concerning.
Yeah. I have to wrap things up a little earlier this week, Tacky, if that's okay.
Yeah, well, it's your show, Joe.
Yeah, it's my show. I forgot. Well,
Don't know, I need it.
it's called AM Quincy with me, so I guess it's my show.
Last time I checked, you can just cut the mic. It's not like, I can sit here and just have moving lips. It's not like I can stop you.
I would never do that to you, Tacky.
In case you're wondering, we're using Zoom as our medium still. So, as the administrator, Joe has enormous capacity of whether or not to just to shut me down.
Which I would never do. But I do have to wrap it up early because I'm actually going to be interviewing an author who is here in Quincy documenting the workings of the Quincy Fire Department 50 years after he did it the first time. So
Oh,
I'm supposed to be on the lookout for that.
that is pretty cool, actually. Someone who actually is going to do a look back, so to speak, and what was yesterday and what's tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm looking forward to that. So I'll let you know next week.
Yeah, it'll be great to hear in that part of the conversation for us. So at this point, the office is staffed 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. I know I keep saying it over and over again, but I do have people in the office. We are working. We're working. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tackey.chan@mahouse.gov. 617. We already did the phone number. We have the state website, malegislature.gov. You can watch last night's session if you're really up for it, as well as public hearings, great resources. You can find your bills. You don't have to call us, amazingly. As you said, information access is out there. At Tacky Chan, formerly known as Twitter, X. You have State Representative Tacky Chan. You've been noticing, if you look at my Facebook, it is a public Facebook. You do not have to be a Facebook member. It's been very, very busy because I've been very, very busy. So, a lot of stuff going on in my life at work, and some of the stuff we talk here, but also stuff you see where I've been, and there'll be more coming up on my goings later on. And of course, we have tackychan.org, which people actually do communicate by. I just strongly discourage social media messaging because it's just too hard to filter through. I get a lot of junk, just as you can imagine. But we have a resource page at tackychan.org, so you can find numbers and reach out to us that way as well. And of course, it's either Tuesday Tacky Tuesday or Thursdays with Tacky, depending on where we are with Joe. So, that's all I got.
All right, we'll leave it there and we'll catch up next week. Thanks a lot, Techie.
Thank you, Joe. I'll talk to you soon.